Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food. My guest today is Christopher Carter, the author of a new book, The Spirit of Soul Food, Race, Faith, and Food Justice. Dr. Carter is an assistant professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. He is also a pastor within the United Methodist Church and has served churches in Battle Creek, Michigan, and in Torrance and Compton, California. And Dr. Carter's with me today. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here today.
Well, I read your book a while ago, and I've been looking forward to having a moment to sit and chat about your book. So I'm sure you talk about this subject a lot because as your position, as a professor, you probably have really shared a lot of these different ideas that are in the book.
Yeah, I think it's been evolving, I would say. Like, you know, I was the benefit of, I think the writing style that I typically had, or at least what I took for this book, is it was so much developed in conversation. You know, the ideas that I suggest at the end of the book were emerged out of my time as a pastor of a church in Compton. And so the suggestions I make, several of them are things that we did. And so at times you might be like, oh, is this possible? I'm like, well, I had a congregation of people that were like, you know, 50 to 80, you know, Black folk, like 50, 80 year olds, just over 100 people doing a lot of this stuff. And so I'm like, and if these, you know, middle class, older people can do this, I think other people can too, you know? And so, it's been, I think that's been the beauty, I should say. It's most of this has been developed in conversation with so many people, and that's been really exciting.
This program is called It's All About Food. And from my point of view, everything is all about food, and most problems can be solved with food if we could get food justice and the food system working properly.
I agree. I mean, and even some of this is just in terms of solving problems, just having people eat together. I think there's a way in which just sharing a meal can open up space for conversation that, because it allows you to settle your defenses, right? And so even just the idea of not just looking at it from a justice perspective, but just from a community perspective, right? How might food be a mechanism for allow us to be open to each other and to others? I find food is an excellent way to get students and people in general to think about more of the deeper moral and social issues that we encounter in the world.
Some of us activists, when it comes to veganism, when we're trying to share our ideas, we need a community. We need a group of people to approach, or people that will be open to our message. And that's a challenge. But when you're already in a community and you are in a community with your church, I've always seen this as an ideal place to share the message about food, because when it comes to a vegan perspective or a perspective about getting rid of exploitation on all levels, the church is an ideal place for that. And yet it surprises me that, well, it doesn't entirely surprise me that there's been resistance.
Yeah, and I agree. I would argue it's theologically inconsistent, but it's not surprising. That's the technical way I would say in terms of with respect to the ideas and ideals of veganism. But to your initial point about religious communities and maybe churches specifically being an ideal space to have these conversations, I fundamentally agree, because these spaces are the places where you're likely to have meals together. You're already having conversations about the deeper issues within the world, within yourself. And so there's already a sense of vulnerability and trust and compassion that's present. And so they are the ideal spaces. I think the challenge we have in America, and perhaps I could say a little bit more to Europe, have been that so many of the social and cultural norms around our industrial agricultural system are so steeped in racism, quite honestly, exploitation, you know, they are steeped in a kind of nationalism that it's difficult to disentangle sometimes for people, to disentangle those positions or those beliefs from their own personal identity and from their religious identity. because sometimes those things are all intertwined and grow together. And so it's important for folks to think about what they're eating, you know, to think about what we're putting in our bodies. And also, and I mean, as you probably noticed in the book, I use compassion a lot. It's important for those of us who have already done that to be compassionate towards others in terms of how we invite them to think about these things and consider these issues, because the system is designed to encourage them not to think, right? Like they're doing the thing that they're supposed to be doing according to the structure of the system. It's designed to not think about these things. Mm-hmm. And so if you have that perspective, it should open up a space, as I say, of compassion for you to not belittle someone, more to invite them into other ways of thinking and to recognize that that's going to take some time in a relationship.
So a lot of the book, or all of the book, is about food and veganism, and you're connecting it with Black history, and you're also connecting it with your Christian perspective and tying all of these things together. I feel like most of your recommendations, if not all of them, apply to everyone, obviously, but you take it from a point of view of your own personal community. So the title of your book is The Spirit of Soul Food. And a lot of us have our own interpretation from culture, what soul food is. And you're opening it up and digging a little bit and giving it a, what can I say, maybe a more compassionate explanation of what it is. What is soul food to you?
Thank you for that. I mean, in terms of that is what I'm trying to do is trying to, I think for me, a lot of the book was about, it began as a personal quest to discern how to eat in a way that was consistent with my morals and also a way that was consistent with my social and cultural identity. And I think at the time of my life when I was struggling with this is when I was in graduate school and, you know, I'm already very predominantly white institution. I'm very disconnected from my community. And so I, at the time I'm thinking about becoming long-term becoming vegan, but in the moment vegetarian, I'm, you know, concerned about further disconnecting from my community. And so for me, the exploration to what soul food is really was an exploration of how do I stay connected to a community and identity that's deeply valuable to me. And so as I began to research and read and encounter, I argued and I realized I would say soul food at its fundamental essence really is the food that was, or I should say the foods and the cooking techniques that were brought over by enslaved Africans that were allowed to flourish and develop in enslavement on plantations, and foods ultimately that were and foods and food ways that were designed to preserve and promote the Black community. And that really is the core of what it is. The foods that have what we would call soul food have evolved over time, mostly due to access, mostly due to obviously there was only a few dietary staples that were able to be brought over from West Africa to America. So the food by its very nature had to shift and had to change. But at its core, at its fundamental essence, it was about the preservation and promotion of community. And I think once I was able to discern that, once I was able to kind of make the connections, and this is really, I would say, you know, one of the best texts that for this was Jessica Harris's High on the Hog, which I know is now a Netflix series, which I have some challenges with while they're doing that, but that is, you know, whatever, it's a different conversation. It was so helpful because you're able to see the evolution of Black food ways, African food ways, so it becomes African-American food ways, and how there are some retentions there, but more specifically how it is about this connection to community, the way in which to tell our story through food. And so for me, that really is the essence of what soul food is. And I think that opens up space, as I argue in the book, for it to not be fixed on certain foods, rather it to be more focused on principles and ideals that really ground what it is we consume, that really are the foundation that I think offer a kind of a compass or direction for how we should be considering what we eat.
In the bigger vegan picture, a lot of us come from different communities, different cultures, and we have that desire to be part of our own traditions, and yet we realize there's a lot of flesh, and a lot of dairy in the foods that come from our religious holiday foods or our cultural foods. And we've all been a part of making these dishes, but making them cruelty-free. And I think that's part of the bigger picture. But I think, like you said, when you move from one place to another, you can't always find the ingredients that you're used to using. And so there's a fluidity in all of this, and it should be that way.
And it's all, and I think what was important for me and what was, I try to articulate in the book, is it's always been that way. It's always been that way. Like, we've always had to recreate, redesign foods based on what was available. I mean, we live in a very unique time in human history where we can have well, if you have money and you live in the West, you can have access to different types of foods all year round. That just wasn't possible for the vast majority of human history. And so we shouldn't consider that as the normative and default. Rather, it's an opportunity for us, I think, to be imaginative and use our creativity in terms of how we might recreate some of these dishes. But also, I would say it's about the stories as well. Like, the stories that go into the cooking and the preparation, the stories that go into when the eating, you know, what the community that's built, that's as much about food, I would say, as anything else. And so oftentimes the challenge with maybe people from, you know, our community who are resistant to veganism, plant-based diets, or even vegetarianism, it comes from their own stuff, like their own parts. And so I was trying to help them tend to that. I have some other, you know, the last thing I should say, because I really can't leave this out, you know, I think what helped me, you know, is the relationship I have with my older family members, my grandparents, especially my grandfather who's still alive. And just the fact that, you know, we grew up poor, really poor. He grew up super poor and just didn't eat a lot of meat. And so it wasn't like, for him, these things had to be there. I think the Black experience, depending on where you fall on the spectrum economically, is such that, you know, if you grew up with the kind of food insecurity I do, it left options for me, perhaps, that weren't necessarily embedded in other people's experience of soul food. And so I think to an extent that may help me realize that it's, again, soul food isn't so much just fixed on eating these things. It's much broader. And that's invitational. That gave me hope, and that gave me the courage to make these changes. And I'm also the primary cook in the family when I go home to family stuff. And so when I'm cooking, it's vegan and no one else wants to cook. And so they just eat it and then they're like, oh, this is pretty good. You know, so, right. so to be fair, I do have some slight benefits that other people may not have.
That's true. I want to talk about cooking, but I'm not quite ready to get there yet.
Oh, totally fine.
I want to talk about agriculture. And I will admit that my education in history was sorely lacking when I went through elementary and high school and even college. And I'm trying to catch up to what really happened in this country. Let's talk about agriculture, because it just, and there's so many things that I don't understand, but how is it that the Black slave knew so much about agriculture and created just so much wealth for this country, maybe not for the people who were doing the work? And then once these people were freed, all of a sudden, all that knowledge didn't mean anything anymore. They didn't know anything. They didn't deserve anything. And it just blows my mind. And of course, all of that continues today. It's a cumulative effect. We have a problem with food justice, with food workers all over the country, not just growing food, but also in slaughterhouses and just everywhere.
Yeah, for me, you know, that section of the book, you know, was, oh man, you know, some of the more interesting and affirming and also difficult things for me to read. And so I went and spent several months on plantations in Louisiana. That's where my father's family is from. And so I got a chance to go to a bunch of plantations on River Road, a couple in Mississippi, and also some in South Carolina. But the majority of the stuff I pull is from Louisiana. And I didn't know, I knew, obviously, that Black people were enslaved for, we're often told, I should say, Black people are enslaved, were enslaved for their physical capacities, right? Their ability to work long hours, their ability to have, we have high melanin, less likely to sunburn, all the other kind of stuff that makes it from a physical sense. When I got a chance to talk with historians, African historians especially, that's when I learned that there was so much more precision in the enslavement of Africans, that plantation owners were very, depending on the crop they grew, or they were trying to cultivate, they would buy Africans from particular tribes so that they would come to America and grow this. So for instance, if you are in the Carolinas and you can trace your ancestry, even if for the most part, if you're Black and it's been in the Carolinas, most likely your family originated from the Senegambia region, because that's the kind of rice that is grown in the Carolinas still comes from that part of Africa, right? And so they were buying slaves from that part to come to here to grow that kind of rice. And the same thing with the Fulani tribe, if people are from Texas. And so there's all these different tribes that they could say, like, these people were growing these things and we want to buy this knowledge. Now, if you look at it from a purely capitalistic sense, it makes perfect sense, right? You wanna get the person who has the knowledge that directly relates to what you're trying to do. At the same time, it requires a level of dehumanization that's what made it difficult, right? So I'm reading these things and I'm like, this is depressing that someone could dehumanize someone so much that they would, on one hand, think they can buy them and purchase them. And at the same time, as you note, acknowledge the fact that these folks that they're enslaving have a particular kind of wisdom, have a acumen that is necessary for our survival. Quite honestly, American agriculture is not only built on the labor and intelligence of Black folks, it's also built on the genocide of Indigenous folks and the Indigenous agricultural intelligence as well.
Yes.
You know, so it's you got these two groups of folks you completely exploited. And then as soon as Civil War ends, or the shift, the tide begins to change, the dominant ideologies around Black people shifts from intelligent, trustworthy, hardworking, but just docile folks who need to be controlled, to lazy, unintelligent. Like, it just shifts to support a particular narrative of control, right? It's all about how can we create and maintain a sense of white supremacy. And that is, like I said, it was empowering for me to read it, because it helped me, I think, claim a sense of agriculture and culinary genealogy, you know, history outside of slavery. Like, and I think that's what I needed. And I argued that's what I think a lot of Black folks need in order to heal. But at the same time, to your point, it further deepens or further helps us further understand that so much of the wealth in this country is built on stolen intelligence, stolen land, and there has never been proper compensation. And that, to this day, really is one of the fundamental challenges that we have with respect to racism, relationships, and trust in this country.
I grabbed a few things that you wrote from the book, and one thing you wrote: soul enabled our ancestors to be critical of a nation that allegedly prized freedom while enslaving millions. This country is all about contradictions.
Yeah, I mean, it is very much about, you know, the ideals that they want to embody, but also limiting to who have access to those. And to your point, this is contradictions. And these, to be clear, you know, these are embedded in race, I would argue, and in gender. Like, I think these two kind of can serve as master categories to an extent. And so when you look at the experience of Black women, for instance, that's when you really get a chance to see how exploitation works in America at its worst. And yes, it is. We are and are consistently still living in a country of contradictions that seems to struggle to live up to our ideals that we say we believe.
Sometimes I just need to breathe. It's just too much. And on one hand, I'm very grateful to be here right now in this time, in this place, where we are at least able to talk about these things. So I want to believe that, yes, we have ideals, we're not living up to them, but we're working our way there. So while I'm saying a lot of negative things here, I just want to say I do have hope and a positive perspective, and I'm glad that we're having these conversations. That's a positive thing. So we went from this food system that thrived on a no-wage system with slaves. And I want to say it's different now, but in some ways, people say that many of us are still slaves. Yeah, we get a wage, but for some, it's not even a living wage. And there's so much compromise. And it's kind of built on that original model, right?
Yeah, our agricultural, our food system today, especially, is still built on the same, it still operates on the same principles of enslaved labor. And that's also a part of, and this is, so to be clear, to your point, right, this is, can be a very sad conversation. And so I want to make sure that everyone knows that, you know, I try to wrap all this in the text with compassion. And so I talk about how can we move through this in a way that doesn't bring us to our lowest lows and leaves us there. But it also is important to know the history and how we got here so we don't do it again. And so the biggest reason, among the biggest reasons, I should say, as to why our food system operates this way, is because as you begin to, after the Depression, and you begin to see FDR and other folks try to shift it, you know, make policy changes to move people out of just crazy poverty, they limit who has access to these benefits due to racism. Basically, they don't, because most Black people in America at this point, most Black and Indigenous, basically, I would say all people of color at this point in America, mostly work in the agricultural sector. And so they limit, they don't allow people in the agricultural sector to have access to Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. They limit the minimum wage within that framework. They put all these structural limitations in so that people who work in those fields who are predominantly people of color don't have access to the same benefits and privileges as white people who work in other fields, right? And so that ends up setting the framework and precedent. This is why we have a culture of tipping in America. And whereas if you go in other cultures, they do not. Everybody that works at a restaurant, they make a minimum, they make a wage, right? They make a, whatever wage it is a wage. They don't have like, and I expected to like perform extra for your money, you know, mm-hmm. for your wage. Right. And so that system is still fundamentally the system that we operate out of. Like literally it's the same thing, whether you're talking about factory farm workers or farm workers in general, there's a way in which their wages can still be suppressed due to policy changes that were implemented that haven't really been challenged since the end or since the beginning of the Great Depression. And so, yeah, there's a way in which, you know, it is so similar. We are at this point, I would say, we operate in a system, life in this country, in life in general, within this colonial framework, is supposed to be to the service of, or it's designed for life to be at the service of industries, of corporations, rather than corporations being utilized for the service of to life, right? How can these organizations, how can these institutions actually help us live a flourishing life? And that's not the case right now. It's very much about how can we help the corporations live a flourishing life, or whatever that is. And that is, that's the flaw. I mean, that is fundamentally the flaw, mm-hmm. You know, ideologically, I should say, within our current framework.
So I was raised Jewish, not really very religious, but as a child, I wanted to know more because to me, I'm like a yes, no, black, white, one, two, either or kind of digital person. And I thought if we're going to be this, I want to know about it and do it right. And then as I studied, honestly, it was the first place I discovered prejudice and discrimination against women. Mm. And it turned me away. So my choice was, I don't want to have anything to do with this. And you're taking a different approach because you have acknowledged in your book that Christianity was not serving the Black people in America when they were slaves. But you make a really important point, and you could elaborate a little bit on this. This wasn't really Christianity. This was through a white lens. And for me, I guess, what I was taught was through a white male lens. But there are good principles behind these religions.
Yeah, no, you were definitely taught a particular form of Judaism that was through a patriarchal lens that was designed to maintain male masculine power, you know, and I think once we get to that point of this is, you know, part of the reason, and I love bell hooks, you know, and rest her soul, recently passed away, her book, Feminism is for Everybody, really, I think, crystallizes so many of the principles that I wish I had. It's so funny, I didn't include it in the book. And in hindsight, I keep quoting her, like, I probably should have, because the term she uses is consciousness raising. And I think that's essentially what we're talking about, this kind of critical analysis of our religious communities and our communities in general, that allows us to examine the assumed knowledges. And so for me, this, by that assumed knowledges, I mean, what are we understanding to be like the default norms that we operate within? And how do we begin to challenge some of those default assumptions to kind of discern what is the, you know, disentangle some of the oppressive stereotypes and structures within those traditions, so that we can actually get to some of the core fundamental precepts of these teachings. And so within Christianity, you know, Christianity obviously was weaponized to support slavery. I mean, when you look at the documents that surrounded the Civil War, like the arguments people made in newspapers, these were theological arguments. And if we could be very clear that the Civil War was a theological crisis, people believed, because the Bible supports slavery in some sense, people were like, well, if I believe the Bible is true, then I have to believe that slavery is okay. And that was their argument, right? And I think people of faith, but Christians specifically, would do well to remember that when we have all these debates about, you know, religion. I'm like, well, hey, you know, we now, I think pretty much everybody would say slavery is not good, right? Slavery is not good. And like for a long time, there was a legitimate debate. So that should add a sense of skepticism, or not skepticism, of critical lens when we're reading these sacred texts. And so for me, because of that awareness, I took to my engagement with Christianity and really examined the, again, core principles of what I see coming out of this, you know, colonized Jewish prophet emerging in Palestine. You know, like Jesus emerged from a Roman occupied Palestine. It wasn't the European Jesus, this white dude with flowing hair. Like, Jesus looked a heck of a lot more like me than he does like anybody. And just so y'all know, I'm a Black man. So, you know, like, there's a way in which we were taught this European white Jesus. And so once I began to kind of peel back those layers and disentangle that, I found a figure that was very much about humanizing marginalized folks, that was very much about upsetting social norms that were oppressive, that was so clear about the importance of justice in the ways in which economic justice, particularly to the poor and the widowed and the orphan, was fundamental to this particular mission and ministry. And so that, I think, is what Black people have gravitated towards within Christianity, and how Christianity was reframed, reimagined through Black, through the enslaved Africans, and also through today, that allows people to still practice it. At the same time, there is a way in which some of those old patriarchal, sexist, racist principles still linger, right? And so that was what I was trying to do, was like, well, how can I help us see, like, this is what we've done that's good. How might we continue to, you know, peel back those layers and continue to examine how this tradition can help us further, right, in our current contemporary context. And so that, you know, I think it was crucial, because if I'm going to make an argument to Black folks about food, the majority of Black people are religious. I was going to have to engage, like you said, yeah, I was going to have to engage Christianity, because obviously Christianity can be a big roadblock. And so I was going to have to engage it if I really was going to try to persuade people.
You're right to view Genesis as a poem.
Yeah.
I like that.
Interestingly, Karen, you know, so many, most of my colleagues in the food movement are Jewish. And so I'm very fortunate that I have a lot of inside information when it comes to how to translate the Torah and what that actually means. And so, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. That's what it was. And it's very helpful because it offers an imaginative reading. But at the same time, you know, it allows us to, we don't see it as something that just purely dictates you know, a kind of logic in, this is structurally how things were created. Rather, it's an opportunity for us to reflect on our role and responsibility within the created world as human beings. And that, so for me, that just opened up a lot of possibilities. And the last thing I want to say, just so I'm really clear about why I engaged religion, because there's a way in which I could have wrote this book and not done that. Obviously, it's actually quite, I know I could have done it, because I debated whether or not I wanted to do it. If I was going to talk about the structural racism in our food system, which is a big part of what I try and do in the text, I had to talk about religion, particularly Christianity, because, racism as it exists in America is so deeply tied into Christianity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't really talk about racism in this country and racism in general unless you talk about the ways in which Christianity and Christian theology has been complicit in structuring it. And that for me meant I had to engage it. I had to engage those anthropological assumptions that allowed folks to say Black people are less than human. Like, that had to be addressed, because those assumptions aren't just this ideas people had. They grounded those assumptions in theological beliefs mm-hmm. that had to be challenged.
I'm thinking about just what you said a moment ago about a lot of your colleagues who are Jewish. And I think the Jewish people and the Black people, unfortunately, have some similar history, both being persecuted people, and as a result, have had to work harder, try harder, be more creative in order to survive and thrive. And the unfortunate thing I get from that is, do we have to suffer to be better?
Yeah, that sucks. that sucks, man. You know, I would say, no, we don't have to suffer. But I think suffering is a part of what it means to be human. You know, in order to really have the full gamut of feelings, of emotions, of the capacity to love, requires us to also have the capacity to suffer. I think by its very nature. And so, you know, we shouldn't have to deal with any of those things. I think we, because of the situation both our communities have been put in, we've cultivated a certain kind of resilience that's given us the tools to know how to respond to suffering in ways that have allowed us to move forward. And that's the beauty of it. It doesn't have to be that way, but we are choosing, as my people would say, to make a way out of no way. And there are so many similarities with the history. I mean, quite honestly, the logics of racism emerge out of anti-Semitism. Like, if you want to do the genealogy of race, and again, that's another podcast, perhaps we can talk about it, but like, you know, my colleague Willie Jennings, who's at Yale, wrote an excellent book that describes this. And any race studies scholars, they know that this emerged in Europe when people were trying to determine, you know, after the Reconquista in Spain, if one could be, like, how far removed from their Jewish or Muslim ancestry could they be before they could technically be Christian? And it was all about blood quantum. The idea of the blood, I mean, it all starts right there. Like, it is the womb that births racism, is anti-Semitism. And so, yes, these two ways of marginalizing folks are deeply more interconnected than I think most people, Black people and Jewish people, honestly probably realize.
Okay, back to cooking now, which is kind of like one of my favorite subjects. I think it's so important that people cook. I always say, find your kitchen. You'll learn so much about food, what's in your food. And there's just so much love that happens when you learn to cook, and so much creativity. And people think, they have so many negative opinions about cooking. And you talk about this in your book. We've kind of culturally been manipulated to believe that cooking is not something we should be doing. It should be something that we give to some lesser class of people and pay them a little, or go to restaurants where we pay the cooks very little, because we don't have the time for this. We have better things to do. And yet cooking is one of the best things that we can do for ourselves and our families. Let's chat about cooking.
Yeah, no, I think it's been one of the most important things for me when it comes to developing not only the book, but also the practices that I described at the end of the book really centered around the idea of being able to prepare a meal. And I realized when I became vegetarian how little I actually knew how to cook. because it required me to really be more precise and to learn how to, I couldn't just get quick fast food anymore. You know, I had to really think about what I was going to put in my body to make sure I felt better and felt nourished. I think what it allowed me to do was to learn not only about different kind of techniques and about my history and think more about the recipes and things that I ate and things I ate growing up and how to recreate those. But in so doing, I was able to have all these memories and tell my wife all these different stories. My grandmother, unfortunately, had passed away before I became vegetarian. And so it's been years just recreating things that she made and bringing it when I go back to visit my grandpa in Michigan and saying, how does this taste? And does this taste like this? Or, you know, and him remembering and then him telling me all these stories about when they were young and doing things that he would have never said if she was alive, because she wouldn't have let him tell these stories. So, you know, and that is, I think, the beauty of it. And to your point, you know, we've been told that this is supposed to be a chore. And it's mostly, this is a deal with women, right? To be fair, this be 100% transparent, right? It's been, you know, when women were allowed to enter the workforce, there's this pivot to say, well, cooking is a chore, so let's make it super easy. You don't have to worry about doing it and give it to someone else. And that really has been to our detriment when it comes to anybody involved in food justice. Because I think we haven't developed an appreciation of the practice of food preparation that I think is crucial for us to think critically about what food justice can look like for folks who have to actually cook.
Another contradiction, isn't it interesting that although cooking is women's work, the great chefs that are honored today are all male.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. That's always been a strange thing to me. You know, most of the cooks in my family have always been women. I would say I'm the first, you know, man in the family that's really been the person. And again, I think because I've grown to really love cooking, I do the majority of the cooking at these large family events. But, you know, like you said, to your point, it's like women are expected to be able to like cook, but then when it becomes being a chef, there's a higher level of expertise that's required. And again, this is where, you know, patriarchy comes in, and that's a bit sad. That's very sad.
Yeah. But with respect to African Americans and African American Christians, as you're focusing on, the idea of growing food and cooking has such a bad taste to it. Pun intended. because of the history behind it. And I guess you're trying to free everyone from this concept because it's only hurting yourself.
Yeah. You know, for so long, I would say particularly Black women, like this is all they were told that this is the best you can hope to aspire to, is to be a domestic person who is involved with cooking and cleaning and taking care of the people's children. Agricultural work was, you know, this was the best you could hope to aspire to if you lived in a part of the country, mostly in the South and Southeast. And so the vestiges of slavery still linger, right? And the ideological, specter, if you will, hovers over it. And so what I found healing, what I try to offer in the text, is to recognize that we knew how to grow food, and we really were these agricultural experts before slavery. And so while growing food, when we think about that, while slavery is a part of our history, it's not the part of our history, right? It's just a part. Mm-hmm. And we can't let that shape the totality of our identities. And that's where I find that some of us get stuck, because we haven't had the opportunity to do the research that I've been able to do to actually explore Black history beyond slavery and before slavery. And that's been really helpful. And so I think that offers kind of a template for people to begin doing some healing, and then also to focus on story sharing when we're cooking. I think that's been one of the more healing things as I've talked to people who've adopted some of these practices. And all that to say, all that's wrapped up in legitimately having the time, which gets to, you know, issues of labor justice. You know, like if you got to work two jobs, do you have time to cook? you probably don't, you know? And so how do we get so that people actually make a living wage? Like all these things are interconnected, like all they're all interconnected, but cooking and eating and sharing stories is just fundamental, I think, into what it means to really have a holistic understanding of food justice and food sovereignty.
That's what makes us human.
Yeah.
Period. And that's why it's so important.
I agree.
I was wondering if you read anything by Rin Barry. Mm-mm. Yeah. So unfortunately he passed maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, and he was a New Yorker and a vegetarian historian. And I'm not remembering the title of his books, but he wrote quite a bit on the religions around the world and their connection to veganism and how they kind of got off the track because he was implying through his interpretation that most religions started from this idealistic moral place, and that included not eating animals. And he talked about the interpretations about Jesus eating fish and lamb, which you talk about in your book. And he had explanations for that, saying that it wasn't really fish. It's been a long time since I read his books, but it wasn't really what was said in there. Just like you said, read Genesis like poetry. There's tremendous misunderstandings through the language interpretations. Yeah. So, you know, we really can transform that story quite a bit to the way we want it to be interpreted.
I think so, but also I think it's important for us to ask ourselves if these people, based on the principles that they set out for themselves, how would they apply those principles today? Mm. You know? And if you look at the ways in which, if we want to take Jesus as an example, the arguments that he made about economic justice, about justice with respect to women, the arguments he made that were clearly anti-colonial and decolonial in nature is the language we would use today, right? About helping, you know, or even about the oppression of the poor. I don't know that he would have eaten. I feel pretty confident his diet would be vegan because that's the only way you can practically apply those things. And right. So, that's in today's context. If we take those principles now in his particular context, well, that was different, you know, it was fundamentally different. And so it's not about, to me, matching it up and saying we have to eat the way that someone ate thousands of years ago. Rather, I think it's important for us to say, what principles can we derive from these figures, whether it be Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, like all these folks had clear guiding principles about how we should engage with non-human nature. And let's take those and ask ourselves, what does that look like for us today? Why do they have those principles? You know, what was about those principles that really shape us? And so that I think is a big important part of how we cultivate and craft an identity around the food we eat.
You talk about some solutions for the problems that we have in the world related to food security and food sovereignty. You just talk about farm cooperatives and some different organizations that are doing some good work. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, this is definitely a solutions-oriented book. I try to have a little bit of history in there. I love to cook, so I have recipes in there.
We're gonna get, I'm saving the recipes for last.
Oh, okay, cool. You know, so obviously, it's very autobiographical. I talk a lot about my own complex ancestry. And the part of the reason I wanted to make sure I included solutions and practical solutions I think people can do is because I think when you consider food injustice, ecological injustice, climate change, it can feel so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And you can almost feel paralyzed. And so I wanted to give people a sense of hope. And also say, well, it is a big deal and you can't do everything, but everybody can do something. And so among the solutions I talk about is practicing what I call soulful eating, which is veganism, a kind of Black veganism. And I call it Black veganism because I want to draw a distinction between, you know, the kind of veganism you might think that's just centered around animals, you know, that doesn't really take seriously the oppression and marginalization of people of color, and other people within our food system. This way of eating is really, honestly, it's a kind of I've heard it called, and some people have challenged me, and that's okay. It's a very anthropocentric kind of veganism. But I think I don't hear anthropocentric and think that that's a bad word. especially if you have redefined what it means to be human, which is what I talk about in the book as well. You know, I think, you know, there are cultures, particularly indigenous cultures and Native American cultures and indigenous African cultures that are very much what we would define as anthropocentric, but don't have the kind of exploitative tendencies that we have in the West, because they have what I would call a non-oppressive hierarchy. In America and in the West, the only hierarchy we tend to be able to imagine is one that involves people marginalizing and oppressing others. The best metaphor I have is think of like a parent-child relationship. Like at its best, you're not oppressing. You have responsibilities, you know, you are in charge, but you're not like doing it in a way that one would say is oppressive or marginalizing, hopefully. And so that's kind of the way I talk about that in the text with respect to veganism. And cooking is a practice I talk about. The other things about farming and food co-ops, I think, and policy work are fundamental to the kind of transformative actions we need to have. What particularly religious organizations, I think, can get involved in this movement by helping to facilitate and create what I call food sovereign communities, meaning either partnering with local farms to have produce brought to your church so people can buy things there rather than having to worry about going to different grocery stores that aren't accessible, which keeps costs low because farmers know they're going to have a certain amount of money they can totally depend on. And the church is a nonprofit. You're not doing this to make money. You're doing it to actually do a service to the community. So that's one thing. If you live in a rural community, and so my sister lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. As I said, my family lives in Louisiana. They actually have enough church land to what I call do church land into farmland and actually grow food, to hire people to do this within the community, to maybe hopefully pull people from these factory farms that are doing terrible labor and these other farming industries that are poorly paying people, hire them to actually be able to grow food, I think is one thing that we can do. And if you live in an urban community, like I live right now in San Diego, you know, I have a meeting next week with people from the San Diego Food Policy Council and Los Angeles Food Policy Council. People like myself who, you know, I can grow some food, I love to cook. I can offer more from a policy perspective. That's where I know I can fit in and do that work and advocate for the kinds of local changes that we can make. We often think that food justice requires these kind of national huge changes, but there's so much of our food policies are local policies, like city policies that can really offer profound change. And so those are some of the solutions that I offer. And I obviously detail them more in the book, but things that I think all of us can find our way, right, to really feel like we're doing something. And the first place that starts for me is what we eat.
Amen. All right, let's talk about some recipes. So I made the collard greens recipe. I have to say, I always do it my own way.
That's fine.
So most of the time I cook SOS free, salt, oil, and sugar free. It's my thing. And so I made the collards with the orange juice and the raisins. I added a lot more garlic to make up for the oil and the salt not being there, but that's a keeper.
Yeah. You know, I would say
really yummy.
You could totally, I was like, you can make that without the oil if you have the right kind of pan, and garlic would definitely help with that. I think I tell this story in the book. I'm pretty sure this is the one I tell is, that's the dish that I use to entice like old Black people to think about veganism. Like, it is like, that's the one, because they're like, they have, you know, my grandfather was like, again, primary test example, where they're like, we eat collard greens with pork. Like, this is what is in there. And when I'm like, this is raisins. He's like, that's not gonna taste good, but he loves me. And so he eats it. And he's like, oh my gosh, this is delicious, you know? And so, you know, I think that recipe is an easy recipe and it's so, so good. And so, yeah, I'm so glad you liked it. I will actually try without olive oil. You know, I got to do a little bit of salt, man. I can go with no sugar. I can go with no oil. The salt, I'm like, I don't know.
I'm not judging. This is a choice. And I just want everybody to stop eating animals. That's my thing. You know, and if you want to use processed foods and sugars and so, that's your choice. That's fine. that won't hurt anybody else. You're only doing stuff to yourself.
Your own body. Exactly.
And that's okay. But I've been on this path for a long time. I've been vegan for 34 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm always just challenging myself and stepping it up. And I don't know, I guess maybe it's a sickness. I don't know. But I like to make it more challenging. So how can I make this dish, which is already vegan, but how do I make it like healthier, but still taste rich and delicious? So I'm going to eliminate all of these things. What now? What can I do now? It's a crazy obsession. But anyway, the dish was very good without oil and salt, in my opinion. And I added more garlic, like I said. But the raisins, it's just lovely. The different flavors you get the bitter, you get the sweet.
Yep. No, I think that's what complements it. And it's surprising, I think, for those of us who grew up eating greens a certain kind of way, you realize there's a lot more flavor in collards than you probably ever realized before. And I'm not sure if this was your experience or if you can even, you know, since you've been vegan so long, maybe you don't even remember, but one of the first changes I noticed was my ability to taste. Like I developed when I became vegetarian, my palate got so much more precise. I don't know exactly what that meant. I don't know any scientific, I've not read anything, but I was like, oh, I can actually taste things and know what they put in it. And it was pretty, pretty amazing. One thing I want to say really quickly, based on what you just said about your own particular journey. And to me, with that, as a theologian, what that sounds like as someone whose spirituality is entangled with their diet. And this is way of consistently, right, striving to say, okay, how might I move closer towards what my ideal might be, right? How might I move closer to embodying this particular, you know, way of being that I think is towards what we would call like religious sanctification or perfection or maturity. And so for you, it's this journey. And it's all about moving towards this particular kind of destination and goal. And in essence, that is what we would define as a religion, as a spirituality. And so for you, it's a spiritual practice. Like veganism is a spiritual practice. I don't know if that helps or hurts or whatever, but that's what you, I was like, oh, okay, absolutely. No, that's a religion. Okay, okay, all right.
I like the way you put it better than the way I put it. And as you know, I have to say, there is a certain amount of, I don't know, we have to put ourselves down sometimes in order to keep the humor going, in order for people to be open to what we're talking about. You know, when I talk to people about cooking with no oil, they're like, ah, no oil. What? You're already not eating animal. Wait a minute. It's a crazy scenario, the way we've been manipulated to follow a certain path. Now, watermelon. You end the book with watermelon. And I want to praise watermelon, and I'm glad you made that choice.
Thank you.
I love watermelon.
I love watermelon.
I was on an all raw diet a long time ago for about 2 years. And sometimes I would just eat a watermelon for a meal. I think it was a little too much sugar, but it was really fun.
Now, I ate a lot of watermelon growing up. My grandpa is one of the things we could grow in Michigan. And then when I moved to California, not as much. And then when my wife became pregnant, for some reason, that was the thing that she could eat and she didn't feel sick. Mm. And she ate tons of watermelon. And that's when I started eating it again. And I mean, it's been, definitely one of the things that I'd love to kind of reclaim, because there's so many stereotypes around watermelon and Black people especially. You know, and so just owning, not only owning that this is a fruit that is healthy, nutritious, and delicious. And it, again, there's pictures of watermelon in tombs of Egyptian pharaohs, right? I'm like, this clearly had a significant significance within the African community. And so again, moving beyond the stereotypes that were cast upon us to reclaiming watermelon has been something that has been really important for me.
I love watermelon. That's all I can say. It's a great food. Oh, yeah. The story of the watermelon. I don't know if anybody's focused an entire book on the watermelon, perhaps, but I prefer my watermelon the way it was originally grown with seeds. And this is just another example of the craziness of our culture, where we're creating foods without seeds that can reproduce themselves. Because what? Seeds are inconvenient? What is that? But I just want to put it out there. I want real seeds in my watermelon.
So as I said, my grandfather grew up as a migrant picker in the South. So he worked on farms. Maybe I didn't say that. I can't remember. So he worked on farms up until he moved to Michigan to work in a factory. So he had never, all the food and things we ate growing up were pretty much stuff either he grew or we got from the local store that was literally like blocks from his house. When that store closed, I started going to a large chain grocery store. He called me, this would have been in the 2000s, early 2000s. And he's like, Christopher, there's things at the store that they're labeled organic. You know, what does that mean? And I was like, oh, okay. You know, grandpa, this is like, you know, food that's grown with no pesticides and chemicals and et cetera. And I describe all the stuff that it is. And he's like, oh, it's like normal food.
Right, exactly.
That's what he said. He's like, it's normal food. And I was like, well, yeah. He's like, well, why are they labeling it? That's what he, and so we got to just really, and my grandfather has roughly a third, fourth grade education.
But he's smart.
He's smart. He was just like, you know, he's like, this is, he saw the contradiction as you're saying to that end. And so, so yeah, eating things that actually are the way they were originally designed or originally grew and evolved, I think allows us to, we forget how good things taste until we have them in their actual natural way.
Exactly. It's crazy, though. We call the industrial hybridized version conventional. So it's not the conventional version. It's the highly modified version. But we've been manipulated to believe that, oh, this is normal when it's not. Whew. Okay. Well, Dr. Christopher Carter, I have really enjoyed this conversation. I love talking about food and I've enjoyed hearing your perspective. So I want to thank you for spending the time with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, that's Dr. Christopher Carter, the author of The Spirit of Soul Food, Race, Faith, and Food Justice. Thank you so much. Be well. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send your comments and questions to info@realmeals.org. Everybody, have a delicious week.